Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that this podcast is presented by mybookie.ag and that if you use the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, that you will get a 50% deposit bonus on your first deposit. And given that you are a listener to this podcast, I would assume you're relatively knowledgeable about sports, and I would trust you to try your edge on the online sportsbook. You can lay down some money and get in on the action at one of the safest online sportsbooks in the world. It's the only one that I am currently using. You can wager on all sorts of different outcomes on mybookie.ag, soccer, football, any major league, esports. You can even create your own player props, which is useful for me because if you know anything about me, I do enjoy a good player prop. So if you deposit using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, you get a 50% bonus when you deposit. And I will add this for listeners of the TakeCast. If you deposit using the promo code MATTEK and you send proof of it to me on Twitter, I will follow you on Twitter and you can have access to me via DMs whenever you want. That's the TakeCast bonus that I'm adding in association with the mybookie.ag deposit bonus. Now let's get back to the show. Hello everyone and welcome to the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. This episode features my friend Jordan Cooper. You might know him as Blenderhead. He does a soccer podcast for RotoWire and is involved in their Slack chat and is also a big-time DFS player, plays a ton of soccer, plays a ton of showdown slates, and Jordan approached me to do this episode after listening to a lot of my showdown podcasts on the Patreon-only version of this show and, you know, a lot of the other DFS-centered episodes of the TakeCast, and really just wanted to reach out and talk about his process and some mistakes that he sees a lot of people making in large field tournaments and the way they deal with median projections. And I think that Jordan's attitude is pretty interesting, even if we definitely don't see eye to eye on a lot of topics in terms of, you know, roster construction and how to apply your bankroll in DFS and a lot of those things. I think Jordan's results kind of speak for themselves. You know, he is actually one of the few DFS players who has posted his, his tax forms, his, I think it's a 1099 from DraftKings on Twitter, because he's not afraid to show that he is a profitable DFS player. Of course, if you like the show, you can always find it on iTunes. You can leave a rating and review if you want to support it. And if you really like the show, you can join the Patreon, which gives you bonus episodes of the show. It as well gives you specific showdown slate analysis. I do podcasts for all the showdowns for NFL, Thursday Night Football, Sunday Night Football, Monday Night Football, and the Saturday games as well, now that we're getting closer to the playoffs. And we have a brand new Discord launch just for the patrons. That's right. Everyone who listens to the show, everyone who is in the, everyone who subscribes to the TakeCast on Patreon, we have a Discord just for those people. And after a quick advertisement, we will get to the show. Daily Roto is a mostly proud sponsor of the TakeCast, a mostly sports podcast. TakeCast listeners can save 10% at Daily Roto with the promo code JANIS, J-A-N-I-S. If you are playing on DraftKings or FanDuel, Daily Roto will help you improve your daily fantasy results this fall and save time in the process with lineup optimizers, ownership projections, fantasy projections, premium content, and much more. They have all the good stuff that you want to help you make money at sports betting and daily fantasy. Their new lineup optimizer will let you build optimal GPP teams with stacks based on their projections faster than I can punt money off betting on Peter Uihlein. Sure, you can play the guys that I recommend each week, but shouldn't you also get advice from a proven daily fantasy winner like Drew Dinkmeyer? Yes, I do have better hair than Drew, but I also have his cell phone number, and that makes me a winner almost as much as it makes him a winner of the DraftKings Millionaire Maker. And it's not just fantasy. They have tools to bet on player props, golf matchups, and a customizable NFL game simulator for this fall. Save 10% with promo code JANIS today. All right, everyone, bringing in my guy, Jordan Cooper. You can find him on Twitter at BlenderHD, but apparently it's pronounced Blenderhead. And that's something I learned from listening to the RotoWire soccer podcast. And as you all know, my favorite thing about this podcast is when people approach me about wanting to be on the show. Jordan did so. So Now Jordan's here. How you doing, man?
Good, even though you hate me.
I only hate you a little bit. I only hate you when I'm listening to the RotoWire soccer podcast and you say right like seven times in a row about something that I don't disagree, that I completely disagree with.
What do you disagree with that I say on the podcast?
I mean, you know, you just are never taking anyone who can get goals. You're never taking anyone who can get goals in a soccer slate. So
those are the least predictive things. Those are the most variant things. So I try to take them out of everything when playing double ups.
Well, this is a much bigger conversation, but you know, we might as well get into it because I think, first of all, if you came to listen to the show because you like the episodes with Levitan or with Silva or whatever, and you're football only, some of this will pertain to you, and some of it won't. But this wasn't even on our prescribed agenda, but this is something I would love to bring up. In the current environment of soccer DFS on DraftKings right now, they have raised the price of set-piece takers so high. If you've ever taken a corner kick, you're minimum $6,000. The only one who never goes up after taking a corner kick is Key. He's the only one who doesn't ever get priced higher. I actually think that embracing the volatility or the variance of goal scorers, as long as they have some floor, is actually a more profitable strategy than it was 2 years ago.
I think it's only not necessarily due to the pricing, but also due to the sharpness of the lobby.
Right.
Like most people don't understand, if you don't play daily fantasy soccer, like
you're playing against the same 11 people every day in every contest. It's not like NFL where the double ups have different people in them, the scores are different, people make mistakes. No one really makes mistakes. Like really once you get to like the $10 or higher level in the double ups, no one's making mistakes.
Right. And you're playing against the same people that you played with 3 years ago when you started also. So, like, when people say that NBA or NFL or any other sport cash games are tough in DraftKings, like, I go, no, play soccer where it's like...
Yeah, it's like you literally are playing the same guys.
Well, it comes down to, like, oh, I like this cheap fullback and you like that cheap fullback, which changed the goalkeeper, and then whoever gets that right, like, the difference in 4 points can mean, in a 23-man double-up, the difference of 4 points could mean the difference of 7th place and 18th place.
Well, soccer is like honestly a super unique fantasy sport because you have this position goalkeeper where the outcomes are literally like negative 6 points or like 24 points, and like very, and like the expensive goalkeeper, so like the equivalent of like, you know, the Drew Brees or the Clayton Kershaw or whoever, like that expensive position where there's only one of them. Those scores can be iterative. Like Drew Brees can get 15, 20, or 25. Clayton Kershaw can get 12, or he can get 18, or he can get 30. But very rare, like, but the outcomes for goalkeepers, especially the expensive ones, like Real Madrid goalkeeper, you put him in there, he's either getting you probably like 14, or he's getting
or
you
three.
Yeah.
Or he gets, it basically comes down to you don't get the clean sheet points if you concede a goal, and then it's not worth it to pay up a goalkeeper. But the low price goalkeepers could give up 5 goals and still end up with 10 points because they've had so many saves. So it becomes the position very similar to defense in NFL, where it's like anyone can score a defensive touchdown, even giving up 30.
The big difference is that very rarely will you see defenses swing a slate in NFL. Like maybe one time a year, there will be a chalk defense against a bad quarterback who scores 2 touchdowns and they sack the bad quarterback 6 times and they're 55% owned in cash or whatever. And like maybe there's one slate a year where it'll get swung like that. But really in soccer, it's pretty much every slate. If you hit on your goalkeeper and you get the clean sheet and the win, which is a 10-point bonus. So basically it's the equivalent of getting a goal after the slates end, you lock up a win, basically.
Right, but you can't predict who that's going to be in the same way that you can't predict what the defense is going to be. Just so happens, like this past week, I had the Packers defense with the 12 points versus having the Redskins. But if you would have played any of the defenses, like...
Yeah, and I played the Chiefs defense, which was similarly priced, similar matchup, yada, yada. They didn't get a defensive touchdown. They were bad. The Packers were good.
Right. So, I mean, but it comes down to the decision-making process in which making that selection doesn't matter as much as the other decisions that you make. And that's why I approach DFS. I get regularly annoyed on Twitter when I do Periscopes of people asking me questions, not just, I mean, because I play NBA DFS, I play NFL DFS, of asking whether or not to play, you know, James Harden or LeBron James. And like, are you spending that much time considering two 10K players that both need to go nuts in order to make a difference in the actual, like, it's not going to determine your slate. Like, if they both put up about 55 points, the difference between one putting up 60 and one putting up 55, like, that 5-point difference shouldn't kill you because you should have made better choices elsewhere. So the thing is that, like, we take, and I know that you had Cardi on, and yeah, this is like, to me, I'm the anti-Cardi in a way.
Yeah, you're not focusing on having the absolute best median projections. That's not right.
Well, the thing is that people focus that. I think you say the two words together, and everyone talks about the second word, and no one talks about the first word, median projections.
Yeah,
where it's a range of outcomes. Where when you say 15-point projection, that can mean 10 to 20. That still is 15-point median projection. It could mean 5 to 25.
Yeah.
Right. It could mean 14 to 16. That would be a great cash game play if the range of outcomes was only 14 to 16. And
right.
You're going to get in between, high probability of getting in between there. But then people look at at sites that have projections, or they make their own projections, and they have Keenan Allen at 18.2, and they have Julian Edelman at 17.6 at nearly the same price. And then they go, well, Keenan Allen's the better play. And I would say technically you're right. From a mathematical perspective, on a little smidgen, you're right. But from a range of outcomes perspective, if Keenan Allen put up 12 and Edelman put up 21, like, that's not a surprising outcome. That's actually within your model. Like that's literally part of your model. If that you wouldn't say that, oh, the projections were off. No, the projections were perfect, actually, because you have to view it as a median projection. So when you go into fantasy sports, whether daily or season long or anything, when you're analyzing it, like, you have to look at it as probabilities. And the thing that you find in society in general, in behavioral economics, is that people, when it comes to probabilities, don't act.
They don't understand. Well,
they
no.
don't understand.
People do not understand probabilities. Like, this is actually something that happens all the time for, what's the weather guy? Kevin Roth. Kevin Roth at RG. Basically, a weatherman's job is not all that different than a DFS player's job. It's assigning probability to something, and it's a percentages game the way anything else is. But if Roth gives a game a yellow and that game ends up getting postponed or delayed or whatever, his mentions on Twitter just get destroyed and people call him a fraud and blah, 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 blah. And really all that is saying is he's saying, you know, maybe there is a 7% probability that this game actually gets called off. And it's hard for him to account for all the variables because they're scheduling and decision makers. He'll never have the insight to. And that's a fundamental misunderstanding of probabilities when people rage at him for a game getting canceled when he says it's pretty likely to go ahead. Just something is pretty likely doesn't mean it's a lot going to happen.
Well, if you take a look at the of actual probabilities in real life examples, is, I know this sounds convoluted, but if I went to Kroger, my supermarket, and they were out of milk, like, the milk guy didn't show up in the morning. He's going to be late. He's 3 hours late. I go and I can't find any milk. Like, I'm obviously annoyed, but I'm not like surprised. I'm not like, oh my God, this is like the weirdest outcome ever. But legitimately, if you went into your grocery store every day for 5 years, it may happen once. It may once that they're out of milk. So that's like 1 in 1,800.
Yeah.
1 in 1,800, you come from poker. I come from poker.
I don't come from poker.
I played
online poker when I was in high school.
Okay, but you understand. Like, I played for a living. I mean, I understand that the probabilities assigned. 1 in 1,800 is like runner straight flush against the set.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that if it happened, you'd be telling anyone you've ever known in poker that you saw it happen for like the rest of your life, because it's so improbable that someone would lose to a perfect that way. Yet if the milk was out at Kroger, I don't tell all my friends about it. But that's the difference in the probabilities of like something that's an 1800 to one shot, like, or something even in college football where a team is favored by whatever, 47 points and loses. It's like, well, that's they're minus whatever, 5,500 on the money line or something like that. It's like a 5% probability is only 1 in 20. I mean, 1 in 20. I mean, that still happens way more often than you think would happen. And then the things that are closer to 50-50, like imagine in DFS telling someone that in DFS, the best way to get all your money in is on like ace 10 versus jack 8, like, which is like a 57% favorite.
Yeah.
Like, but that's DFS. But now we're describing the edges in DFS. But if you,
I mean, I don't know. There are very few people who are good enough to be 57% against anyone else. Like, maybe at like the lower stakes, you can definitely be 60-40 over somebody. But if you're like playing like 109 games, just very rarely are you ever going to be 60-40 over anybody.
Right. But those are the edges in DFS versus poker, where like you could get your money in so much better spots. It's the same thing that, you know, like why you hate me for being a nit in DFS.
I mean, I'm kind of a nit too, but in a very different way. Is like, I talked about this on the last episode of the show. I'm actually not sure when I'm going to post this one. I talked about it with Joe Holka, but basically like I don't play DFS for a living. I like have income that comes in outside of it. This is like, I buy sports tickets. I buy like whatever, like dumb commemorative shit off eBay with DFS money. And so I actually should be way less of a nit than I am. I should be like jamming it in. I should be entering bigger contests. I should be playing way more tournaments, and I'm really not. So maybe I'm too much like you.
Well, I mean, I'm doing it for an investment. I mean, I'm playing. This is not my living, but it's a substantial portion of my income.
Right.
But I'm playing in a way where it's like, do I put my bankroll into doing this, or do I put it into an index fund on the stock market? Like, what's the better return? Can I get an 8% return playing DFS or a 5% return?
Well, the thing about DFS is that return is going to, that return is not going to be iterative, especially if you're playing tournaments. That return is likely going to be, you're going to be pretty, like, if you're a good player, you're a good player who knows to avoid like making dumb mistakes, you have access to good projections, likely you're going to be pretty close to break even or maybe losing to the rake, or you're going to be good, or you hit a tournament score here or there. And that makes that, it's like goalie scoring. It makes all the difference getting that one or two bumps from winning or like placing high in a tournament.
Right. But in the difference between poker and DFS is that in poker, like, I could get all my money in like at the end where someone's willingly able to call me when I have the nuts and like there's no more cards coming out. Like there's no chance that I lose this hand. It's a matter of how much money can I make on this hand versus am I going to lose? Or with one card to come, you're a 93% favorite and your opponent believes that they're actually ahead. So they willingly put in their whole stack, even though they're drawing to like a 20-1 shot. In DFS, we don't have the opportunity to, at the end of the slate, right, me to go, you want to bet an extra $100 on whether or not I have a better score than you? Like,
it's all predetermined.
Right. So with that much variance, where the biggest edge you could have is maybe 60-40, like, why am I going to play like 10% of my bankroll a slate? Like, it's more likely you do that in poker, if anything. Even though
I play way less than 10% in every.
Well, people say 10% and I laugh at that because I play under 1%.
Yeah, I play at any given time. At any given time, I have, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 on DraftKings. And I'm like, in NFL, and just because I'm so confident I will never get that wrecked in NFL, I will go over 10%. But I would never do that in a soccer slate.
Right, but your bankroll is not just what's on DraftKings. It's just like What you've set aside.
If it's my life role, it's like what it's like under 1%.
Right. But then you're closer to me. That's kind of
if you don't play DFS professionally, keeping part of your life role on a daily fantasy site is like so suboptimal.
Right. Well, it's better to just, you could put it into like a money market account. Better, more so that you're going to beat DFS.
Or a mutual fund, or buy gold, or buy Bitcoin. This is a great, I have no idea your thoughts on Bitcoin. Do you own any? Do you think it's dumb? What's your thought on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency?
I don't even pay attention to it. It doesn't satisfy utility theory, so I can't believe in it. It has no utilization. The example that I view Bitcoin as on why the technology could be useful, but it's a sham from a utility theory perspective.
Using it for transactions, using it for payments is like dumb and bad.
Well, even if it was, like, I'm a big studier of behavioral economics. Like, that's how I treat DFS, as a game. It's not, has nothing to do with sports. But Bitcoin is the same way, where to me, Bitcoin would be similar if we had a construct, if I could build this story of there's an arcade. You used to go to an arcade, maybe not you, Davis, but I went to an arcade.
No, there was an entertainment center in Salina, Kansas.
Okay. I'm 39. I've gone to an arcade before, but a lot of arcades, you put in your coins and then they give you tokens. Like, you put in your that arcade tokens, not quarters, but they're the same size, but they can only be used at the arcade.
Yeah.
So now picture, you go in, you go, I'm going to get $10 worth of these coins so I could play these video games. Because you need to have those coins in order to play video games. And let's say, for instance, that there's only $50 worth of, only a certain amount of coins that are available, right? Similar to Bitcoin. And in order to play these video games, you're going to need these coins. So if another kid comes to the arcade and like the arcade's like, well, we're out of coins. You have to get it from someone else. Like, someone else could go, well, instead of giving me 25 cents a coin, give me 30 cents if you really want to play these video games. So the price of the coin goes up, right? So as more people have demand to play the video games.
Well, the difference is that Bitcoin does have the utility to turn back into whatever currency you want to turn it back into. You can't take your token and have that returned for quarters.
Well, no, you can't, because you could sell it to someone else. That's the point that I'm making. You could sell your coin. Okay. I could sell my coins to someone else that wants to play a video game. Like, but what happens when the video game shut off? What happens when the arcade goes out of business? You have a whole bunch of coins that have no utility to
them. Well, we're seeing it right now because Bitcoin is at its lowest point in a year and a half.
But the price, the only reason why Bitcoin has a value is because other people think it has a value, even though it doesn't actually have a utility. The arcade doesn't exist. So as long as there's someone willing to convert the Bitcoin back to dollars or whatever fiat currency,
yeah,
it will still retain value. But like Bitcoin in and of itself, like if I get stuck in the middle of nowhere and I need a tow truck, like Bitcoin ain't going to help me.
Like, yeah, I mean, you can't keep all your money in it, of course.
Right. But it gets back to daily fantasy of biases. And why, same thing for probabilities, why people don't take into account that the example of like Keenan Allen versus Julian Edelman, of people, they spend so much time. I'm on Discords, I'm in everything, in everything of, is Keenan Allen going to do well on Sunday? Or insert player name. Or is so-and-so going to do better than... Is Christian McCaffrey or is Ezekiel Elliott? Who's going to do better? And
right.
I spend... It's not like I spend no time on that. I spend the basic amount of time. People ask me for NBA, what stats do you look at? It's like, I look at the same stats that you look at. Do you look at Vegas? I look at all of that. How much time do I do? I look at that for maybe 7 minutes total. And then every other piece of time, I'm weighing the opportunities of everything else, because you'd be much more accurate. Davis, if I had to ask you, like on this past slate, for instance, about Jalen Samuels and go, which would be more – you would be – if we had a bet on who would be more accurate within 10% variability, you have to project his fantasy points. I have to project his ownership. Who do you think is going to be more accurate?
In this specific example, I would actually say Samuels was like pretty projectable. And like, I actually think he like almost actually dead hit his median projection, but I would say not in this specific example. If we ran this 100 times on 100 different players on 100 different slates, the ownership projection would be way closer to being accurate than the median projection would.
Right. So, I mean, like, if I have to go, like, if I know a guy's going to be high owned or somewhat owned or whatever, I could put a number. I could put this guy's going to be about 15% owned. Most likely, I'm not going to open up when it locks and he's going to be 38% owned. And most likely, he's not going to be 2%. It's not my skill in knowing who people are going to play based on they look like good plays. And I may agree that they are good plays. But the goal in DFS at its core, you have to think very similarly to poker, where, and same for any type of probability. We talked about how people don't know how to process probabilities. If I could give you, Davis, a 20-sided die and say you could roll it and your number, you pick whatever number you want. And if you hit that number, you get 100-to-1 return. Like, you take my bet all the time, right? Because it's a 20-to-1 shot that you'd be right, but you're getting paid 100-to-1. But you know that you're going to be wrong 19 out of 20 times. Like, you're going to lose $5 19 times, but the one time that you win, you get paid five times more than you should get paid. So when it comes to median projections and ranges of outcomes, you have to think in terms of not whether or not you're going to be right. It's whether or not you're going to be right and you're going to be paid more than you should be for being right. So when someone in a tournament is too highly owned for his likelihood of, quote, busting or underperforming, like, even if they do hit, you're actually in a negative EV spot because you're not getting paid enough, especially if you're playing like the Millie Maker, depending on the payout structure of the GPP.
Yeah.
So that's why, like, we talk about in, quote, cash games, there's no upside in cash games. Like, coming in first doesn't win you any more. So you don't gain anything necessarily
for being that much more correct.
That's correct. Right. Exactly. Or hitting the upside. I played T.Y. Hilton and he got what he may have saved your lineup because you chose him and it protected other duds in your lineup. Coming in first at a double up is wasted points because you're not getting paid for that. But in tournaments, playing, like, when people say, oh, so you're saying to, like, whoever's high owned, you fade them. I go, you only fade them as long as you believe that the return that you get from them is not, you're not getting paid for it. If we saw that Christian McCaffrey was minimum price at 3K, like, that's not Jalen Samuels at 3K. That's not Jeff Wilson at 3K. That's like someone that's going to be on the field.
So how good? So, like, obviously Christian McCaffrey is never going to be minimum price, but how good of a median projection does, like, a super chalk guy have to be for you to want to play him, whether it be NBA, whether it be NFL, whatever? Like how good would a play have to be to, like, justify 70% ownership in tournaments and you playing him in your lineups?
I'm going to say an answer that you're not going to like. It depends on the slate. It depends on who else is available.
Well, let's say these questions aren't
answerable.
No. So we can come up with a good example for this in something that, like, we've seen plenty of times before, and NFL will be most relatable to the listeners. So let's say it's not Jalen Samuels, right, who had the threat of Stephen Ridley, but we can even go back 2 weeks ago to the Spencer Ware game when Hunt was suspended, Ware was in there against the Raiders. I mean, he was like the fifth highest projected running back of the week, basically. And I thought he was like a no-brainer, lock him in 100% every tournament lineup play. How did you approach that Spencer Ware situation?
I lock buttoned him.
Yeah.
He was a lock button situation to me only because based on your lineup construction, that you were to go, there were no other cheap running backs that were worthy enough of taking that had a high enough probability of reaching what would be maybe 4X value or something. So you'd have to rely on a wide receiver for that, and that's a disaster. 4K wide receivers are not all that reliable. And
no, but that is the answer, though. That's how you create a lineup that is so different that basically you're guaranteeing yourself a unique roster construction if instead of Spencer Ware, you take Deshaun Hamilton or Dante Pettis or whoever, and you know that 6% of the time when Ware busts and that guy doubles his bust score, you're basically locked into not only profit, you're locked into exponential profit where you are getting paid off way more than the percentage of times that you are right. You're getting paid off 100x as opposed to the 18x of like the expected probability.
Right. But actually in that situation, I chose to play Spencer Ware because I believe that the payoff of not having him in, I think it was a plus EV situation of differentiating elsewhere, only because the ownership would be so projectable in other spots as well. Like my attitude is not necessarily, I'm more inclined to eat the cheap chalk of that magnitude than eat the expensive chalk. Like I'm, if Michael Thomas is chalk, I don't play high priced chalk.
High priced wide receiver chalk. What about high priced running back chalk?
In tournaments, you could do anything you want. And I mean, high priced, because there's not many of them. Like, that's the problem. Like, in running back, it's like they could be three, they could be four. You play the one that if the ownership, you have to look at the delta in ownership, not just how high they're owned. I'm using obviously this pass legged as an example. But like if Christian McCaffrey is 32% owned and Ezekiel Elliott is 27% owned, it's like that's not enough of a difference that like, well, I'm going to play Ezekiel Elliott because he's going to be lower. Like just play the better play. Whoever you think is the better play, just play them. If Alvin Kamara is going to be 7% owned and he's in that range and you think he's going to be 7% owned, you could go, well, maybe I play Kamara with McCaffrey or with Elliott, but I use him. Because I think, but if Kamara ends up being 18% owned, it may not be worth it even at that delta. But then you look down the scale and you go, well, who in here can hit a high portion of their range? Because remember, median projections are just a range of outcomes. And you go, like, which guy could do it that people aren't playing for whatever, like the difference is, that's why I make the Keenan Allen Edelman difference. So this, and they're similar types of receivers also. They're possession-based, low ADOT-ish type of receivers.
Right.
We'll see, like, one be 30% owned and one be 5% owned. Like, to me, those are the leverage points. And then seeing who's going to be popular, what positions they're in, and what constructions that you are. You don't – that's why, like, the example that I hear on so many podcasts of, like, well, this guy's going to be 60% owned. Obviously, he's the easiest one to fade. I'm like, well, he could also be the easiest one to give you a score that no one else at their price range could possibly give you at the higher end of their range, that it's better to just eat it then. As long as you feel like if you're playing a single entry, like three entry, this is kind of counterintuitive. You'll hear the opposite advice. I'm more inclined to fade the highest chalk in a single entry field
as opposed to a pump 150 max,
and it's not, and it obviously depends on the exact issue, is it's more due to bias. Like I said, I spend 7 minutes thinking about what the players are going to do, predicting player performance. I spend all the rest of my time how to exploit other people's biases. The same thing at a poker table of I'm spending most of my time not worried about whether or not I raise.
So break down your process for me, NBA slate, NFL slate. What contests are you entering? How many lineups are you making? Kind of just break down the Jordan Cooper process.
Okay. Well, I mean, I could like NBA probably the better example only because the projections are so much more higher probability. I mean, NFL, you get touchdowns, so everything goes all over the place. But if you play NBA.
Yeah, NBA easier to talk about because it's more iterative.
Right. And also with the injury news that comes out every day, value just pops up out of the. I mean, like you get the Jalen Samuels, Jeff Wilson, Spencer Ware like every day in the NBA. This guy's, you know, the highest usage guy on the team is sitting, you know, and then like everyone becomes a value. I mean, like, and then it just comes down to like what value is good value? Is this value better than that value? And it's like you can make any lineup you want. But all I do is I go, okay, what are the Vegas totals? What are the, I mean, I look at the bare basic information. I look at who's in, who's out. Oh, when this guy sits, then this guy gets a usage bump and all this type of stuff. But that's typically like all of that is what you'll find on like the podcasts and the articles. And like, to me, reading like Notorious's grind down on RG for NBA is not must read content, but it's kind of like this is the basic stuff. Like there's nothing special in it, but it's like, that's the 7 minutes of research of like, you know, he noticed the things that I noticed and any other good player would notice. Like, and it's not complicated when, you know, when Chris Paul is out, James Harden usage goes through the roof. And when he's back, you maybe don't play them together. I mean, like, it's the common stuff we see all the time. So looking at that and I go, okay, let me take a look. And what are the good plays today? What are their price points? What's the construction going to, there's going to be a cheap $3,600 guard available.
Yeah.
At point guard. And they're a point guard only. So now that's going to take up your point guard spot. Is there any value at power forward? That is going to be, that screams at you. No, there isn't. But there is at small forward. It's like small forward, I think one of these two 4K guys is, can put up 22 to 25 points. So I'm like, okay, he'll be in my cash game lineup as of now. So I start putting this all together and I go, because of these two, the popularity of these two people, what are people going to be led to do? They're going to go, well, center. It's like, well, you take a look. It's like, oh, well, Whiteside's out, and they haven't priced Adebayo up enough, so I think maybe he's going to be popular. So I plug that guy in, and I go, I think the highest-owned player on the slate on the top end is going to be Anthony Davis. And you go, well, how do you know that? It's like, because there's no value at power forward, and tell me what other power – what you're going to pay up at power – people are going to pay up at power forward as of now. Obviously, it's 6 o'clock. News comes out, and everything changes. That's the whole thing about NBA.
Right, yeah. Everything changes in an hour.
Right. So I see that, like, the value, the popular value, which could still do fine. Like, when I mean value, like, if someone is 4K and they give you 25 points, like, that's great in double ups. Fine, play them. But it may not be good enough to win a big field GPP that night in NBA, just getting 25 out of a 4K. I mean, you need a top 99.9 percentile score. So I take a look and I go, all the value is in the guard spots. There's no value in power forward, other than some very risky plays on the low end. Playing Marvin Bagley, hoping he gets 26 minutes against a team that can't rebound well. But does he get into foul trouble? There's a lot of risk there that people aren't going to look over there because they're just going to pay up for Anthony Davis. So I look at that and I go, okay, based on as long as nothing changes, this guard's going to be 30% owned, even in the big field GPP. This small forward's going to be 20-ish percent owned. And Anthony Davis is going to be the highest owned stud at maybe 22%. Maybe it's an 8-game slate or something. And I go, like, well, AD could put up a 50-point game, and, like, that's not good enough for an 11K salary for GPP.
Yeah, so you're playing Russell Westbrook. You're playing
there you go,
Giannis. Right. You're playing, yeah. I mean, and that is, like, people. It is true, though, that in tournaments, people generally don't really think that way. Like, Anthony Davis is always way more owned than LeBron James, unless LeBron has, like, people play LeBron when there's, like, a narrative. So, like, people played him against Miami because, you know, like, whatever, he had the narrative with Wade, but people generally err on the side. Like, Anthony Davis is a very good example because people just always play him.
Right, but there's a very high probability, more so than you think, of him going to the locker room, even if he's not injured for the game but missing the third quarter. Or there's more ways for it's the ownership difference between, well, because people say it's like, well, how do you play Russell Westbrook against this team? I go, the hashtag defense doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, this is what I need. This is what I was hoping we would get to. I need to know how much, like, defenses don't matter or, like, just disregarding matchups plays into your projection, lineup construction kind of stuff.
Like I said, the main way I play DFS as a game, it has nothing to do with sports. Like, that's the secondary aspect of it. When I hear people go, like, who's going to get Jimmy Butler defense? I go, well,
who cares?
I don't say who cares. No, I think it's the wrong attitude to say who cares. I care because if other people care, I care.
Yeah.
Now, Jimmy Butler may be Robert Covington, all the top defense. Who's going to get?
Here's the thing: Jimmy Butler's not even good at defense anymore. That's like, that's an edge in NBA is like figuring out like who people think is a good defender, but actually is not. And that's
right, but
that's a really good one because Butler doesn't play defense anymore.
But that's the point that I'm making is that, like, even if we see it in NFL, like I think we saw it this past week with like Richard Sherman, like. You'll hear people go, like, who's going to get this cornerback coverage? And go, well, do you understand that, like, NFL, if they want to get Michael Thomas the ball, they will set up a way to get him the ball. In the same way in NBA, where if they want Kevin Durant to get the ball away from Paul George, like, they'll just have a high screen and get them the matchup that he wants. Like he will.
The edge is always in projecting how the defense influences the usage, not how the defense influences the efficiency. And that's
right.
True. That's true in basketball. That's true in football. That's true in anything.
Yeah. But the biases, I look at the biases and go, if people, I'm more likely, see, this is why I don't like talking about plays. Because players as who's a better play. So if you tell me that correctly, like we have the correct opinion that like those matchups, people outweigh that. And they go, well, this against this pass defense versus this rush versus this defender versus whatever. But let's say the field, the public actually thinks that and goes, well, it's Michael Thomas and they'll find him the ball, whatever like that. And he's going to now be owned more than he should be. I'm going to go from the other end. Like some people don't play. We see this with the Memphis Grizzlies sometimes. I mean, it's a very micro example of Jaren Jackson and J. Michael Green. Jaren Jackson is a fantasy beast as a power forward. The problem is he fouls too much. So like, he's priced at $6K, but he's like, he could be a $7,500, $800, $8,000 player if he stays out of foul trouble and plays 35 minutes. J. Michael Green is $4,500 and like he's the other.
So which side of that do you take in tournaments? Do you take the side of like, oh, I'm going to take the guy who is going to benefit from the foul trouble?
No, I take the guy that other people are not going to take.
I feel like Jaren Jackson is always pretty owned, though. I feel like when I run, and I mean, here's a big difference between you and I. I don't make tournament lineups by hand. I do it all in either on Daily Roto's lineup optimizer or on Roto Grinders' lineup HQ, and I just exclude guys that I don't like, and I bump guys I do like, but I don't make any lineups by hand.
No, but I only make mid-stakes lineups by hand. Like, The lineups that I've won GPPs where I play three entries into like a 44, like I make those by hand. But when I play the 150 maxes, like I'm playing 50, 60 lineups, but I'm doing it with lineup HQ. But
this is something I would love. This is what we're gonna close with. Showdown. Got to talk about Showdown with you because I assume you've been playing a fair bit and I love Showdown. So I want, first of all, your general thoughts on Showdown as like a business model for DraftKings and if they view it as their future. And I guess, I mean, I don't play on FanDuel at all, but I know they have a version of it. And how much are you relying at or looking at projections for Showdown?
Showdown projections are worthless. To me, at least, I like Showdown NFL. The problem with Showdown is you have to play, it's so important. It's you have to play it as a game. Drew B, Drewby gets it.
Yeah, I mean, he gets it.
Drewby is a goat. I know.
And eventually we will have Drewby on this show, probably actually on the paid feed, probably on the Patreon. We are going to have Drewby on to talk about showdowns.
I've won showdown also, so I'm a showdown person also. I got the Aldrick Robinson. I got his jersey because you got to play him in showdown.
I mean, Aldrick Robinson is definitely running a scheme where he and Cousins like are going all in on showdown through like some means. They have a cousin who maxes showdown slates and they get him the touchdowns.
Right. Well, I got 50K on the game that he had the two touchdowns, but he was 3% owned. But the thing is, the way the current showdown format is, until they change, if they change it, which it may be better if they did change it. Your goal is not, it's counterintuitive. Your goal is not, if you're going to play what I call the $10 luck box, which is the only contest that I play.
So what I do is I do three handmade lineups in the $10 luck box. And then I do 20 entries in the $3 and the $1.
Oh, like, I typically do 20 entries into the $10 luck box, and I hand make all 20 of them.
Yeah, but I would not hand make 20 showdown lineups.
Yeah, but it's the same. It's the same line, because basically I've done your process that you do on your Patreon feed is very similar, other than the fact of when you play, it's so important. This is why people lose at DFS when they're good. Where I've been playing for 4 years and I've never come close to winning a GPP is because you're playing the best plays and not playing the game of DFS.
Yeah, in showdown, you just got to be like, okay, this is here. I will give away an edge that I talk about all the time on the Patreon. Basically, playing the highest priced running back in showdown is bad 70% of the time, the way that DraftKings scoring works. It's just, in general, you're not getting the return. You need them to score twice because, Todd Gurley is always overpriced in these things. I have not played Gurley in showdown yet.
Or
you do that. Or you go, I'm going 100% Jordan Howard. I'm going 100% Latavius Murray. I'm going 100% Chris Carson. Those are, like, really the only two ways to do it.
Right, but guess who had Derrick Henry in the captain at 7 out of 20 of their lineups.
Did you win? Are you rich now?
No, because I didn't get, because I had Snowflake. The whole point of that $10 contest is that, like, you look at the, if you look at the payout structure of that contest.
Yeah, you have to win.
Right, you have to win. This is a winner take all.
So two times this year, I've been 1v1, the perfect lineup. And I even remember the times that they were. It was the Chiefs-Patriots showdown. And I was 1v1. Chris Conley was in the winning lineup. And I had, you know, some loser or whatever in the Conley slot. And then the other one was the Miami-Houston showdown slate. I think it was a Thursday night game. And I was 1v1. Tyler Irvin in the slot versus Jordan Thomas, and the Jordan Thomas side was the winning side. But like on those slates where I was literally 1v1, the absolute perfect lineup, I broke even just because that's the way those, you have to get the absolute nuts.
Right. Which means that if you're taking players in your lineups, and people are going to take this advice too far, and I'm going to explain the second part. If it locks and I flip over and look at my lineup, the ownership percentages. And if everyone is over 20%, there's no chance that you have alone the first place. Like if it's over 20%.
I wonder how many times even a single lineup has won those. Like, I think it's
we've
probably
seen it before.
I bet it's like 10% of the time tops though.
Right. But the second point is that your goal is to win. These contests are negative EV unless you're shooting for first place. So if you're going, I'm going to take the best plays and then put in a defense. Like, if you open up the thing and everyone's over 25%, you've now lost money. There's no, like, if you come in first, it'll be a 72-way tie. You're going to get paid $1,400. And a lot of people say, well, but if that's being right, like, that's the whole option of, well, I like $1,400 for a $10 lineup. I go, yeah, but you're not getting paid the return.
Right.
You're rolling a 20-sided die and getting paid 12 to 1 on being right. I'd rather be wrong most of the time, but when I'm right, like be tied seven ways. Right. Yeah. But I know I may not be the only one with this lineup, but I may be only
five people.
People are playing Deion Lewis because he's better than Derrick Henry, at least for fantasy scoring. So I looked at that. I look at a showdown slate the same way that I described before. Who are other people going to play? And how often do I need to be right in order to disrupt when Deion Lewis is 50% and Derrick Henry is 24%? And then, like, there's no chance that they're going to put Derrick Henry for PPR scoring in the captain spot. And I go, well, this is a garbage game. So maybe there's just a lot of running. Someone breaks off a big play. And, like, no one, I played Kessler and O'Shaughnessy. So I played that angle. And I still played Fournette because I figured, even at 12K.
So that's like the thing that you got to do. I actually disagree with you a little bit. I think that you need to try and tell yourself a story with these lineups. And like, that's a good way to approach showdown is being like, okay, this is how I think this game is going to go. So if you think that if you have a Derrick Henry lineup, you should not have Leonard Fournette in there because you're expecting the Jaguars to pass the whole game. You're not expecting Fournette to get 28 carries, and because Fournette's such a plotter, like you should have had Kessler or Westbrook.
No, I should have. There was different 2v2 that I could have had, but that's not the story that I'm telling. You're still talking about sports. I'm talking about we're on such a garbage slate.
I do totally agree with your approach. Like, I think that your approach is good, and if you take that way, you do have an equally good chance of hitting the unique good lineup as the approach that I talk about on my shows, which I think, and it's a mix of both game theory, because I will always give game theory plays on those shows, being like, okay, look, we're not going to take Kyle Rudolph because it makes no sense to play a 30% owned Kyle Rudolph when he hasn't hit 20 DraftKings points all year. So we're just going to flat exclude him. But I will apply a little bit of football logic, being like, well, yeah, the game is going to go this way.
You're playing but that's correlations.
Yeah.
What I was saying with the Fournette play was that this slate is so bad that
Fournette, the correlations don't matter.
Not even that the correlations don't matter is that Fournette, even at 12, is not going to pay off 12K, but his 14 raw points, because I have Derrick Henry so uniquely in the captain that I'll take the 14 raw points from Fournette and then hope O'Shaughnessy to Kessler is the tight end touchdown, and there you go. And then I wouldn't show down that way, rather than fade Fournette for and then leave 4K on the table, because who else am I taking raw points wise that I think is even going to? But that's the reason why I like DFS in general, is that every slate is different. Every hand in poker is different. It's not, do you raise with ace queen under the gun, or do you do this? It's like, well, who's at the table? What time of day is it? Is this guy tilting? What are the stack sizes? Everything's always going to be different. And in DFS, you get that in every sport every day. So there aren't any definitive answers. Davis, you could play a lineup in showdown in NBA and NFL. And I look at it and I go, well, we're 3v3. And I think you have a sharp lineup. And you'd look at my lineup and go, we're 3v3, and I think you have a sharp lineup, because you could understand why I played the people that I played.
Yeah, it's all about understanding the logic behind it.
Right. But when you have lineups that have no – when people play GPPs and just scatterbrain, have no like logical sense of – like you see in baseball a lot of times that GPP winners
– In baseball, I'm pretty certain that if you were just like, look, I'm not even going to look at median projections – I'm just gonna stack five guys from whatever. I'm gonna throw a dart. I'm gonna land on a team, and I'm gonna stack those guys against X pitcher. You probably would get like at least one good tournament score a year,
right?
Just because baseball is just a random luck variance fest sometimes.
Yeah, but that's the reason why the good GPP players are as good. When how do they know to take the Phillies? It's like, yeah, because they're. It's the price, like their stack price was so low in comparison to the ownership difference when everyone's taking the Indians at high ownership and high pricing. And it's like they didn't, those people, because people are trying to find the answers of what did they see in the Phillies? And I go, they didn't see even a team name. they saw a 2-5 batting order stack that was 14K, that was going to be three times less owned, that against a fairly below average pitcher in a fairly decent ballpark, and said, why not build 100 lineups around it? And you're trying to figure out why Rhys Hopkins hit a home run. They're not looking at that. They're looking at, why do you think Aaron Judge has four times more likelihood to hit two home runs than Rhys Hopkins? And if you're going to think that, then I'm not going to play it. But if everyone thought the opposite, they would play. That's the point that I'm making. Is like, if the entire public thought that so-and-so was a bad play, that makes me more likely to hope on the instance that he does do well.
Yeah. All right, you wanna plug anything before we get out of here?
Well, my Twitter, Blender HD. I always have to say it that way, even though it's Blenderhead, but whatever.
And if you wanna bug him, you're always in the RotoWire Slack, right?
I'm in everything. So whatever. And I do Periscopes where I yell at people. So feel free to whatever. This is the main basic reason why, if I yell at you for stupid questions, the stupid questions are like, is so-and-so a good play? And it's like, until you would have to explain a half an hour of how you play DFS for me to then go, well, that makes logic based on how you play. So I don't care whether or not Marcus Smart versus Jaylen Brown, like, either is fine. If you want to make one choice and I want to make one choice, that's fine. But I'm not going to spend 5 minutes breaking down how they dribble the ball.
All right. If you guys like this, maybe Jordan and I will do, we'll do one behind the paywall. Maybe we'll do like some more specific strategy insights behind the paywall at some point. But yeah, follow him at Blender HD and check him out on the RotoWire Soccer Podcast.